want your soul.
It all started when my mom started eating detergent by the spoonful. At least it did for me. Kaylee said her mom had been chewing cigarettes for weeks by that point, and her father had gone from eating pumpkin seeds to the wrappers in just a few days. When I spent a few days hiding out in the diner, I checked some of the old papers they had lying around and noticed a troubling pattern of stories about people eating strange things that started up about 6 weeks before things got ugly. A farmer was arrested after stuffing his face full of compost at a gardening store. A lawyer was thrown out of the local courthouse after he tore the judge's gavel out of his hand and gnawed on the handle like a chipmunk. They'd just been stories at the time, but they were actually hints of what was coming. It makes me wonder if it was in the water, or the air, or the food. We knew pretty quickly it didn't spread from bites. God knows there were plenty of those going around when things got bad. Kaylee was missing a chunk out of her palm from when she found her brother digging up the dead dog, Gizmo. I got bit too when I had to leave my mom behind. I was terrified I'd get it because of that. Even now, I sometimes wonder, do I have it, or am I okay? I don't know. We were always so hungry. Those guys in the jeeps and helicopters did a damn good job of keeping us all trapped. I often wonder if all those people they shot down smelled. I hope that when those men went to sleep in those makeshift barracks, they were kept awake by the stench. I watched my 6-year teacher get shot in plain sight just because she wanted to escape the mass hysteria, tearing our town to shreds. We were all so proud of how out of the way our hometown was, how there was just one road in and one road out, one solitary bridge. But it just made it easier for them to trap us in. Kaylee always said it was their fault, that those men in black were the ones who released some fucked up chemical, and it was all just some government experiment. I hope that isn't true, but after they cut the internet and the TV and started shooting anyone who got close to the cordon, I'll never be able to think of the government as the good guys again, no matter why they did it. They knew some of us were still alive, even after months with no supplies or aid, but they just waited for us to starve. What little food there was had to be guarded jealously. When I first left home, I joined a few others trying to survive in the church, but it was too centrally located. Anyone who was infected kept coming up and asking for food, and it was too hard to tell who was going to be okay with us and who wasn't, who had it and who didn't. All it took was letting one of them in, and they'd eat through a whole year's worth of supplies in hours. And you couldn't even get mad, not really. 3 times we lost most of our food to someone we tried helping, and every time it just broke my heart. When I found Gabe, who I knew as the older brother of one of the boys in my class, he looked quite normal, albeit a bit starved. But by then, weeks had gone by without power and a lot of people had died, and everybody was terrified. We'd all lost weight, but he didn't look like the others did, not straight away. When I had to jump over to my mom to reach the front door, she didn't even look human anymore. Her skin had gotten so loose it draped over bones and muscle like velvet. And her gut was so big it was the size of a moving box. Gabe looked pretty much normal and didn't do anything bad until he'd been with us a while. He tried to control the hunger. God bless him. He said as much when we found him chewing the sharpened edge of an empty can of corn. His gums and mouth shredded into stringy bits. His stomach was so big it threatened to burst, and you could plainly see things other than food in there, trapped up against the tissue-thin skin. The infected just couldn't stop eating. Bugs, mud, shit, wood, metal, anything. A few of them must have been locked by their loved ones early on, and sometimes I would hear them when I went out on supply runs. Something was still alive in Dr. Sandhurst's basement nearly 6 months after it started. I saw it when I looked through the above-ground window. I couldn't possibly say if it was Dr. Sandhurst or his wife, or even Alec, his son. Whoever it was, they'd lost all their hair, and their skin had turned gray like concrete. They'd eaten away at the cartilage of their own nose and any other soft bits they could get their fingers into. You think that after that much punishment, someone wouldn't be able to walk, but this thing was strutting around like a tiger, pacing its enclosure, stuffing fistfuls of soil into its mouth. It was like there was all this energy bundled up in a small space, and I startled back from the window with the realization that if they saw me, they might just do more than wave and say hello. It makes me glad that the window was fogged up. It probably stopped them from seeing me, and it also kept me from seeing too much of them. Seeing that shape moving in the darkness, trapped after months of starvation and impossible hunger, was enough to give me nightmares. Sometimes I wonder if they're still down there. I know it's silly because they cleared that place out pretty thoroughly. I don't know what they did with the buildings, but if you look on Google Maps, it just shows the woods, as if there was never anything there to begin with. I hope they thought to look in every nook and cranny, but then again, they missed me, didn't they? I got out of that town eventually, and somehow some of those things would just keep on living when it made no sense, almost as if the sickness that starved them made them sturdier, more resilient. I try not to, but I often think about how it must have been unspeakable torture. I'd lost 40% of my body weight by the time I finally escaped the quarantine, and the hunger during those first few weeks of chaos was the worst thing I've ever felt in my life. There were times I wish I could just die, but that was normal starvation. The infected, the look in their eyes, and the things they do just to fill the hole in their stomach, it must have been 1,000 times worse. It was bad enough for us, though. We were always hungry. I never said those words, though. It was an unwritten rule. If you were hungry, you did something about it. Anything. Even if it was just to take your mind off the pain. But to start talking about it, pleading or crying, that was often the first sign that you were infected. It wasn't just that the infected lost their mind or went nasty. It was that they couldn't resist the desperate urge to ask. It was pathetic, but the worst part was how strangely effective it could be. You might wonder how a whole town can eat its entire food supply in 6 days, and the answer was found in young kids begging their parents for something, anything, while tearing insulation out the walls to force down their bleeding throat. It was in pregnant women pleading with their husbands for more, twisting the knife by swearing the kid'll miscarry if they didn't get the food. They were every bit as bad as addicts, worse probably. If there were a string of words they could put together to get even just a crumb out of you, they'd say it. And they'd say it with conviction too, putting on the performance of a lifetime. And if you refused for long enough, they'd just go look for somebody else, or at least they did most of the time. They changed over time, becoming more and more determined. When the pastor went, he went in a flurry of rage. The way he saw it, he had an itch, and he needed to fix it. And when Neville tore the tin of beans out of his hand, he acted like he just watched his infant son get kicked in the teeth. He was so angry, he didn't even look like the man I knew from early Sunday sermons. It was a personal anger, a vindictive and petty fury, the kind of thing that drives normal people to homicide and murder. And that's exactly what happened. The pastor beat Neville's brains out with a crucifix, and then something in his eyes changed once more, and the hunger took over. I don't think he killed Neville with the intention of eating him, is what I'm saying, though. He killed him, and then once Nev was just meat, the pastor couldn't help himself. I'm not sure why I make this distinction, except to maybe show you that it wasn't like The Walking Dead. The infected were definitely alive and conscious, and most of them would start eating drywall before taking a bit out of you, unless you tried to take the food out of their mouth, like poor Kaylee did with her brother. But once you were dead, you were just raw matter. And as the hunger got worse, they'd start to find new and desperate reasons to resort to violence. The end result was the same, I guess. People found reasons to make other people dead, and once the soul had left the body, there was nothing they could do to stop themselves from digging in. I guess the biggest difference was that they lived long enough to feel regret for what they did. For the first 8 weeks or so, most of the infected would be crying when you found them, mumbling apologies and explanations for the shameful things they did. Eventually, more and more of them starved to death or killed themselves. But the ones that stuck around until the end, like I said, I don't know if something changed inside of them, but they were bad. I often wonder what the end game was for the infection. I can't tell you how, but I guess I can at least explain how it began. With my mom, it started with bigger and bigger meals until one day she cleared out the bank account at the grocery store. My dad came home and freaked out. While she had every single top on our stove burning away with all kinds of food. Pasta, meatballs, chicken, potatoes, cabbage, beans, you name it. There was no meal plan, but at least she was still cooking the stuff. I kept asking my dad if my mom was sick, and the way he looked nearly made me cry because he didn't really know what was going on. We could not get her to stop eating. It was like we didn't exist to her, and it reminded me of when we'd visit Nan at the home, right at the end when she wouldn't even recognize us. Dad told me we'd call a doctor in the morning and let my mom do whatever she needed to feel better. He slept on the chair watching her cook until God knows when, and I stayed up in my room, staring at the ceiling with this aching pit in my chest, If I slept at all, it was short and fitful and dreamless. And when the sun rose, I went back downstairs to find my mom washing dishes, guzzling detergent soap like it was a Coca-Cola. My dad was out back smoking, stopping once in a while to stuff the still smoldering cigarette into his mouth before lighting another one. "Have you seen Mom today?" I asked. "Yep, I have. She's been taking a break from cooking, which is a real bummer if you ask me. I've been waiting hours for her to cook some breakfast up, but she's refusing on account of being tired and wanting to clean up. I think she ate it all. Can you believe that? I'm bloody starving," he said. His eyes were vacant and he didn't look at me. It was like he was speaking to himself. He had changed since I had last gone to bed, and that aching pit in my stomach grew about 10 times heavier. "You aren't going out to the shops today, are you?" he asked. "Going to see Kaylee or maybe Brett? Wouldn't mind grabbing some food for your old man, would you?" he said. Sure. Yeah, that's fine with me," I answered, frightened by the look in his eyes. "I'll leave right now." When I returned to the kitchen, my mom had thrown up the green and red froth all over herself and was busy rubbing it into the dishes. Every now and again, she'd stop to shovel a spoonful of laundry detergent into her mouth, retching and gagging as she swallowed it in colorful puffs. I reached to touch her arm and she faced me with eyes that pointed in different directions. "Would you mind being a darling, honey, and popping to the grocery store today?" she asked, sucking her lips dry with a wet popping sound. "I'm not feeling very well, and I think I need to eat something to get my spirits up," she said. Sure, Mom, I think I can do that for you," I said, stifling a sob because I was so damn scared of what the fuck was going on. "I'll leave right now for you." I wanted help, but I really did, but I also wanted to get the hell out of there. So I geared up, got on my bike, and rode into town. I tried not to think too far into the future because I didn't even know what was going on. My mom looked sick, and my dad did too. I just wanted to get into town, see a few people, maybe ride to Kaylee's and speak to her. And then afterwards, I could figure out a way to help my parents. But things had gone to shit quickly after that. The mechanic shop at the edge of town was on fire, 3 empty cars burning down to their skeletons while black smoke choked the sky. I couldn't see anyone, but there was a familiar smell in the air that reminded me of bacon. I pedaled onwards and looked for some sign of coming sirens, but there were none. The closest I got to one was a police car half-mounted on the curb by the diner. I went in and saw no sign of the driver, but did find a young man in the kitchen. He was down on his hands and knees, stuffing raw meat into his face. I called out to him, but he didn't turn, and the animalistic snorts and snuffles frightened me so much I left quietly, tiptoeing to avoid his attention. I thought I was going to come across some kind of riot, but I never did. Main Street was filled with people walking around slowly, some down on their hands and knees. All of them were eating, though. One was grabbing pennies from the fountain. One was chewing broken glass from a shattered shop window. A row of them were gnawing on the wood from a small bench. That kind of mass hysteria is terrifying. Seeing people act like animals is disturbing, but when it's a bunch of them, it becomes something else entirely. I knew something was seriously wrong here. All those glassy, bloodshot eyes tracked the gritty pavement like they were panning for gold, and every mouth had become broken and gored, smeared with blood so they looked slightly clownish. Teeth were spit out and gobbled back up like dogs eating a treat. Half-chewed tongues were sucked down like gobstoppers. One man was tearing at his toupee like Saturn devouring his son. When a pigeon tried to land on a bench, the crowd went mad, scrambling in a sudden explosion of fury. Have you ever seen videos of fish just going wild in the sea, like they all start scrambling in terror and jumping into the air? And there's just some poor bird getting dragged out of sight by some eel or catfish? Well, it was just like that. Dust, clothes, litter, it was all tossed up in the air as every hand and mouth scrambled towards this lonely creature who quickly realized its mistake and desperately started to reverse course. But it was too late. A hand clamped around a wing with a sickening crunch and the poor little thing disappeared into the crowd, and I was thankful that I couldn't see what happened. I rode out to Kaylee's, deciding not to stay in town for another moment. I found her wandering the road just outside of her dad's farm, blood trickling down her left hand from where her brother had taken a chunk out of her. She told me about her mom scarfing down 3 mice she'd found in a humane trap they'd set, and her father who cleared out the garage of paint by tipping the cans upside down over his face, sucking down the strange colors like it was syrup. And of course there was her brother, who'd been driven to such an extreme rage when she'd torn her dead dog out of his mouth that he'd attacked her savagely, hitting and kicking her until she lay on the floor sobbing, begging him to stop. He finished off the dog, its body long since desecrated. Kaylee told me it sounded like someone eating jerky, but she didn't have the strength to look up or even run away. She waited for him to finish it, and after he was done cracking bone and sucking marrow, he stumbled around in a daze and wandered into the woods. After that, she left, desperate to know what was happening. I had the misfortune of telling her it wasn't just her brother digging up a four-month-old dead dog, or her father inhaling paint and vomiting it back up, only to try and eat what he'd just thrown up, or even her mother tearing through the attic, stuffing cobwebs and fat hairy spiders into her mouth like they were delicacies. I told her that I'd seen it with my own eyes. Our whole town had gone completely fucking nuts. When we returned to the town, we found that the crowds had scattered. We never really figured out how many people were infected at once, but just about everyone was hiding or looking, so the place was a ghost town. We scoped out a few shops, but found them torn apart brick by brick, along with a few lonely stragglers too bloated to move, lying in the debris and chewing on rubble and dirt. I remember checking the exotic pet store because it had been cleared out, just like the restaurants, and some morbid curiosity in me wanted to know why. It was only a little place run by a weird guy who always wore a Metallica t-shirt and had a lizard on his shoulder. I used to go in there all the time as a kid and stare at the rats and snakes and scorpions. And I knew a guy at school who'd go there regularly to buy crickets for his pet tarantula. I found the owner on his back groaning and begging for food. His lips were lined with a white gritty paste, and all around him lay smashed terrariums and sawdust that smelled totally terrible. When he spoke, I'd catch glimpses of fur and insect legs still stuck between his teeth, and I left him screaming insults at me while I tried to keep from vomiting. Kaylee and I quickly figured that the usual spots weren't going to work out. Every now and again you'd hear a scream or a cry in the distance, and it was a constant reminder that people were out and about, doing everything they could to find some food. That was when Kaylee suggested we check out the church, since they did food drives and weren't exactly what most people thought of when they went looking for a meal. That was how we first found the pastor and the handful of others who weren't infected. I wouldn't join them straight away, but Kaylee did, and I hung around while they came up with a plan to get out of town and look for help. Over the last day or so, about a dozen of them had gone driving off, but there'd been no news of them. No one had called or sent help. And with the internet going down that morning, there was a strange sense of isolation we all wanted to see proven wrong. So that was how I saw my math teacher get shot. By the way, I traveled with them to the cordon, just hoping to find out a little bit more. When we first saw it, we cheered because we figured it meant a big government presence would keep us safe. Only Mr. Grimswell, a crotchety old bastard who did the gardening at school, said it'd be a bad idea to approach the soldiers. "I told you this is how it'd start," he said. "I told you they'd come sooner or later with their guns to put normal folk like us in place. Most soldiers wear a flag. Those boys over there ain't got nothing to show who they are, and let me tell you, that's some fucking bad news right there," he said. At least he didn't say "I told you so" when the pastor and a few others finally crawled back to safety, bits of their friends and family still dangling off their hair and clothes. All that gunfire attracted a bit of a crowd. And once some of the infected saw those choppers and cars, they started going up and begging for food with predictable results. It'd take another 2 nights before the gunfire finally stopped. I don't know if the remaining infected finally figured it out or if they were just too messed up in the head to follow the winding road out of town, but eventually the cordon became a dead zone where nobody went. We only had a few thousand people in our town. I reckon about half of them got shot stumbling up to those guns, hands cupped together while begging for scraps of anything they could eat. I fed my mom what I could, but it didn't do much for her hunger. It was like something was wrong with her head. She snatched the food out of my hands and stuffed it so fast down her throat she didn't even chew, gagging and retching until it slid down her gullet hole like she was some damn bird. And as soon as it hit her belly, her eyes clouded over, and she looked at me like she didn't even remember me coming up and giving her something. "Do you have anything, baby? Anything for me? Please, I'm so hungry," she'd say. I fed her everything I could and tried to leave, my chest close to collapsing, but she was still crying with pain, so helpless, so desperate. Of course, that changed when she heard the crinkle of a wrapper in my pocket. She bore her teeth at me like a dog, and she didn't so much as speak as bark words. I don't like to think about what she said except to say that she picked on some nasty things. I think if it was just insults and swear words, it wouldn't have been so bad. It was that what she said had this ring of truth to it, like she was spewing up all the nasty thoughts she'd ever thought about me, but kept it buried out of love. "I have to eat, Mom, I have to eat something. Please," I cried. "I haven't eaten in days and I'm starving too." But it fell on deaf ears. When I took a step towards the stairs, she was so angry she grabbed the sofa and started to drag herself. Or at least she tried to, but she didn't get very far. By now she'd swollen to a huge size, part bloated gas, part sloshing stew of rotting food and random shit she'd eaten. It made me sick. It wasn't fat. It was more like what happens when you wrap a sheet around a load of clothes and drag it across the floor. She looked like one good shove would cause her skin to tear open like a zipper, and all her insides would come pouring out. There'd be a lot in there. All the stuffing of our sofa was gone. The fabric upholstery of one chair, half a rug, all of it torn and eaten in thin strips as she'd lain there with her jaw chewing and chewing and chewing. And yet she looked starved. Aside from the enormous swollen belly, her arms and legs and face were totally emaciated. She looked like a spider with those thin spindly limbs and fat abdomen tucked in the center. And her eyes, they had started to go a little funny too, turning yellow and spotted with blue veins. The right one had even started to shrivel a little, like something had a straw in the back and was sucking all the jelly out. Somehow there wasn't a drop of fat on her, and yet she'd eaten so goddamn much. I couldn't even begin to imagine what was happening inside of her. And I only managed to fall asleep through sheer exhaustion. It was more like passing out, and when I finally woke up the following day, it was 3 in the afternoon. My mom was still screaming at me. I don't think she took a break during the entire night. And my dad was still outside. Seeing him there suddenly filled me with so much shame. I left him to rot. Despite everything that had happened the day before, I just left him. I spent the afternoon burying him, stopping occasionally when my mom's taunts became too much for me and I had to kneel over and sob in frustration. But when I was done, I went over to the church and asked to stay, and they welcomed me with open arms. You could see they had a rough night too, and Kaylee explained they'd spent it having different people come to the doors and start shouting abuse in the hopes of getting food. At least I had a decent dinner there, the first in a long while. I felt guilty about it knowing where my mom was, and I had to fight the urge to save some of it and take her. At least the adults had a better sense of how to organize our time. A small garden was set up in the back with a strong fence after we noticed some people had taken to eating the bark and leaves off the local trees, and we did a lot of trips out into the town to gather supplies. We built up quite the store, and for the most part, strong language was enough to keep the infected away. After days of gorging themselves on literally trash, they were sickly gross things that swayed from side to side and kept repeating the same questions. It was like they all had dementia or something, although every now and again they would explode in anger and try tearing the door off at the hinge. We'd just wait them out, though. They couldn't get through those huge oak doors, not without some serious equipment. And for the most part, they didn't seem too keen on thinking ahead, although a few kept a hold of tools and would try to use them later. I'm ashamed to admit this, but I didn't go to see Mom for a long time after that. Things were so busy after spending the night in church, I agreed to go on a supply run that very morning. But by the time I got back from that, I was in no state to go anywhere. We'd been going from house to house when we broke into the Wellman's place. Of course, Mr. and Mrs. Wellman had celebrated a new addition to their family just 8 weeks before, and I don't know what happened to that kid. I spent hours each night wondering what happened to those people's minds. They definitely had a preference for actual food, but if they couldn't get that, they'd look for the next best thing. Random stuff, just like soil and dust or clothes. I think that was the last resort. So after all the proper food was gone, the next things to go were animal shelters and pet stores or barns and farmyards. And there was one guy who kept setting up traps to catch some of the stray dogs, definitely one of the sharper infected. He never did succeed, mainly because whenever I saw one, I'd smash it to pieces. Once all the big animals were gone, the cows, sheep, horses, deer, boar, goats, the infected started going for all the little things. We found one guy stuck in a dumpster eating the maggots that had been laid all over his infected gut. They ate him, he ate them. I passed him at least 3 times a week, and I kept waiting for him to die, but it was like he and the flies were in some kind of weird life cycle that sustained them both. Not to mention, there was just so much of him to rot and fester. He filled the dumpster like insulation foam, his sad little face sticking out from what should have been a neck, while his chubby fingers shoveled white worms into his mouth. Spiders, rats, centipedes, worms, crabs. Jesus, by the end, the trees in the park didn't even have leaves left. Birds didn't even really sing anymore. They certainly didn't land much. If it moved or breathed, the infected would shove it, squirming and wriggling into their mouth and suck it down with a wet slurp. They were fucking disgusting. And even if it was dead, weeks gone by spent rotting in the sun, they'd chew on its tough hide like leather and eat every last hair, bone, and piece of stinking cartilage. So of course they ate each other too when they died. That guy eating maggots, when the others found him, they cracked the dumpster open like a mussel and gorged themselves on the fat flesh inside. He didn't even wake up until they were elbow deep in his gut. Given the smell, I couldn't blame them for thinking he was dead. But by then, he was dead. The only concession they made was that one of them got up, grabbed a massive rock, and beat him to death while the others feasted like lions on a zebra. So, what happened to the Wellmans? I don't know. I think about them all the time. Did they forget to feed the baby and then once it was gone, their hunger overtook them? Or did something inside their primitive lizard brain take control? A baby isn't quite like a human anyways. Not really. We act like they are, but deep down they occupy a different spot in our collective minds. Something elevated and praised, for sure. But for some people, a baby just isn't quite the same thing as a real, full-blown human. They're helpless. Did their hunger make the necessary distinction? When I found them, they were sobbing. They knew what they'd done, and their shame was in some ways the hardest thing for me to face. Somehow, the idea that they'd eaten her reluctantly made it worse if they'd torn her apart like monsters. They begged me to kill them. That's how much shame they felt when I found them knelt over a bloodied white blanket wrapped in a bundle. They begged and begged and begged me to kill them with anything I had on hand. Like I said, I was in no state to see my mom or anyone after that morning. A week passed, a whole week. When I finally returned home, my mom was quiet. She didn't even talk when I entered. I wonder if that's because her brain was mush. Her eyes were these tiny little raisins dangling from withered optic nerves. The bruised sockets all cavernous and hollow. So she must have been blind. Deaf too, perhaps? She was breathing, though. These horrible, labored, wet drawls that sent shivers down her exposed gut. In the time I'd been gone, she'd torn out her hair and eyebrows and was already starting on the lobes of her ears. She didn't look like my mom by that point. She looked like a monster, like something that belongs at the bottom of a well in a gothic castle. When I tried approaching the stairs, she sensed me. Maybe it was the vibration in the floor or just the ambient heat off my body. But she lashed out at me with those spindly little arms and all the terror just came flooding out of my mouth as a gut-wrenching scream. It was just too much to see her like that, and to fear her, to be scared of my own mom. God, it just hit me like a truck. I managed to jump out of her reach mainly because of instinct, but when I landed, I collapsed like a sack of potatoes and just sobbed. It was like I was paralyzed. I couldn't move. I could only shriek in grief and horror, and occasionally suck a tortured breath into my aching lungs. And the entire time, my mom just kept hauling herself forward. She barely moved more than a few inches each time. But eventually she reached my ankle and took one leg in both hands. She held my calf like it was a piece of chicken, and I just watched it like it was some kind of movie being projected onto the back of my eyes. Sometimes at night I can hear the sound of her slapping her palms across the floor as she dragged herself forward. I see her face as she opened her mouth and gouged a small lump out of my skin. I often wonder if I would have let her eat at me, one bite at a time. If it weren't for Kaylee rushing in and dragging me off, God knows what would have happened. After that, I abandoned my mom for good, and I didn't look back until a few months later, just before we enacted our desperate escape plan. I wanted to say goodbye, but my mom was dead, and I was secretly thankful for that. But whatever had been wrong with her had twisted her body into something awful. I couldn't tell what was decay and what was sickness, but it looked like she started growing things all along her gut. And there were birds in there, mangled ones. Had she lured them in and eaten them? It almost looked like they'd landed in her open torso and it had snapped shut on them. I don't exactly know anatomy, but I'm pretty sure ribs aren't supposed to be jagged and sharp. In the end, things were bad. The infected were mostly dead and rotting, and we had some trouble with cholera after one of them must have dropped dead in the water supply. Of course, there were fresh infected as well. Whatever was happening, it could sometimes jump from person to person, although we never figured out how. But whenever one of our own was forced to leave, we rarely saw them after a few days, which was a little odd. They'd camp outside the doors and wail and cry and beg, and then one day they'd just be gone. It was like a kind of natural selection, I think. The ones who stayed alive the longest were, I don't know. They might have been smarter, perhaps, or just nastier. But I think they were the reason those people didn't stick around. We even stopped going out at night. Not because anything happened, but because the feeling of eyes on your back was so palpable, we all agreed it was just a bad idea. We weren't alone, no matter how quiet things got. You could hear them crying from time to time. It was a pained, angry howl, desperate and hungry, not like a human's at all. More like the sound a fox makes when it screams, but a little more hawkish. You couldn't help but wonder. I'd seen people eat glass, bone, offal, maggots, rats, plastic, tissue paper, pine needles, safety pins, feathers, and one time I had to roll over a dead nurse to reach the keys to her car. A hypodermic needle had jutted out from the folds of her stomach and jabbed me right in the thumb. It begged the question, what was there left to eat? And what happened to the ones who just kept on going, starving and changing, deep down in the dark? When one of the other survivors suggested that we try escaping via the sewer, the image of those wet tunnels left me with the same ache in my stomach that I'd felt watching Dad eat cigarettes. Naturally, the discussion turned to the rumors of some old tunnels left behind after World War II. We'd all heard about them, but I always figured they were false. Turns out not only they were true, but I'd seen the hidden tunnel away in the mountains myself. Kids all around the place would go there to smoke and drink, because the opening offered decent shelter from the shitty weather. But no one ever had the balls to cut through the thick padlock chain that held the rusted iron gate shut. And I'd always figured out it was a sewage thing, or was it just a dead end? Mr. Rawson, the oldest among us, said it really was that simple, and that the kids around here were dead right. There used to be an old listening station on the other side, tucked away on an old well-hidden beach. Men going that way could always be expected to make the long cross-country hike to the isolated coast, so a small tunnel had been commissioned and cut clean through the mountain to the other side. His father had used it, he said, and he'd even heard of some environmental agency using it to cart equipment over there. The problem was that the beach was surrounded on all sides by a cliff, and the miserable sea wasn't going to welcome any of us for a quick swim. Our only hope was that the beach had escaped the government's quarantine, and we'd be able to get some kind of radio or phone signal. It was frustrating to think we might be one dinghy away from safety, but it was really our only hope. And as it was, the cordon was slowly being drawn in. Helicopters were flying overhead again after months of silence, and after we'd seen what those men did to our friends and family, we weren't keen on finding out what their plan was with us, few remaining survivors. Whatever we were dealing with, it was contagious. And they'd made their solution to that problem pretty plain for everybody to see. But God, it seemed so easy. A quick hike through the woods and we'd be clear. A part of me thought about that tunnel, what I'd seen of it as a kid. The way the steps led down into inky black darkness, and I shuddered. We weren't alone, I remembered, and we mustn't forget that. What we didn't count on was the cordon. They'd had a whole army of men around the town, and that meant covering the woods and mountains, too. I think we just figured they'd police the roads and nothing else because of how steep the cliffs were around us. We were wrong, and the first sign of it was what we got when Kaylee's neck exploded and I heard screaming that I didn't even realize was mine. Mr. Rawson was next. Watching movies, I always thought bullet holes were neat little things, but the old man's chest looked like something out of that alien film by the time the bullet had done its job. They were single shots that came our way, thunderclap bangs that echoed out of the trees so loud it felt like a Greek god was tossing thunderbolts our way. We never saw who was firing, never had the honor of knowing who was popping heads and blasting limbs like we were enemies in a fucking video game. There was just a sound, an explosion, followed by a dead person, and none of the shots missed. One crack of thunder equaled one less person and one more spray of crimson-red mist to mark the verdant forest floor. "Get down!" someone screamed, and I listened, dropping to my hands and knees and scrambling. Every time I heard a loud crack, I'd sob, waiting for the bullet to hit me. I wasn't mourning the people around me. Truth is, I didn't actually care. Every thunderclap made me think only to myself, or how bad it would hurt to die, or whether I'd have to live long enough to see the damage done to my own body. It's funny to me, but all the complexity of a human psyche boiled down to the simplest of urges in those terrifying few minutes. I didn't want to experience pain, and avoiding it was the only thing I had in my head. I reached the entrance and realized I was the last person left. I still expected one final clap of thunder and hoped that if the shooter had any decency or skill, I wouldn't hear the shot that killed me. But when I propped myself up against the gate, something odd happened. It swung open and I fell backwards. And the space where my head had been just exploded into dust and metal. With a great cry, I rolled backwards and hit the dark floor with a hefty thump that knocked the air out of my chest. Turning my flashlight on, I took note of my surroundings and shuddered. The tunnel was red brick, the floor ancient and dusty. Here and there, bits of loose stone littered the floor, and cobwebs drifted down lazily from the roof, disturbed by the currents I had whipped up. The only light was the small disc of my torch, and I swung it side to side, desperately trying to make sure I was alone. Checking myself, I realized I had no injuries, and that small radio we carried was still clipped to my belt, along with a fully charged smartphone. I might have felt a small flare of hope in that moment, were it not for the creaking swing of the rusted iron and the knowledge that I had to push through, God knows how long, of pitch-black nightmare fuel, all while buried under a mountain. Also, I'm not very brave. I'll admit that now. Once when I was a kid, my dad propped me at the top of a very tall slide. There was a line, and kids half my age were waiting, staring at me, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't push myself off the edge. It wasn't even that far, and I knew it. Something about trying to face my own terror, though. I just couldn't cross that threshold. I spent probably a good 2 hours in that tunnel trying to make myself walk forward. The light helped, but the tunnel curved and lost sight of the gate real quick, and once that happened, there was nothing but the torch. I didn't know how else to explain it, except that the darkness felt tangible, like it was brushing up against my skin, and I was alone. And in the time it took for me to adjust and adapt to the situation, the deaths of all my friends and family started to really sink in. I was almost definitely the last survivor of the town. A small place, sure, but it was my place, and now it didn't exist, and if the whole town could be wiped off the map, what chance did I have in the face of such colossal darkness? Darkness that seemed to manifest in that moment, not as an abstract idea, but as a very real thing all around me. A cloying, suffocating emptiness, a threatening absence of life. The same little voice was with me, the one that had followed me everywhere over the last few months. It was what had kept me out of basements and attics, out of factories and warehouses and alleys. It was what had stopped me from leaving the base without company and weapons. It had kept me alive. You're not alone in this place, it told me, over and over, just like it had for months. Except before, where I could at least listen to that voice and act on its subliminal directions, now I had to ignore it and march further into the darkness. Every step made the world move. There was no light down there except for me. Every breath, every tremor, every step shook the world like an earthquake so that the shadows twitched and danced. It was awful. The realization came suddenly and I stopped to wipe my face of snot and tears, sucking in a wet gurgling breath while I did so. The shadows fell still and the tunnel was mostly silent. Mostly. I whipped my light around and stared behind me. There was a whimpering echoing off the walls, so faint I'd mistaken it for my own crying. I held my breath for so long it felt like my lungs were going to burst, willing myself into total silence so I could make sure I wasn't mishearing things. The curved wall and ceiling meant that whatever it was, it sounded both far and near, both high and low, and it dawned on me that if I got turned around, I'd never be able to figure out the right way around. Finally willing to do something sensible, I grabbed a small rock and carved an arrow into the wall. The scratching sound mingled with the faint, tremulous cry, and I prayed to God that whatever that sound was, it was somehow behind me. Could I have missed another turning? Yeah, I could, very easily. I was in a world of my own down here, struggling just to keep my bladder under control. And that was the best case scenario, at least. I'd wandered past whoever else was down there, and that was that. But the worst case scenario, my brain told me, was definitely more likely at this point. I still don't know how long I was down there. At one point, I stumbled across a padlock surrounded by teeth and some very faint bite marks on the solid, glistening steel bar. It must have been the one that was used to shut the gate, though I still don't know how it had been torn off the door. In all likelihood, it was opened with the key, or maybe the rusted bars had just given in with some force. I pushed on regardless, ignoring the implications. Something about the sight trickled down into my subconscious, though, because when I passed a small bar of metal no longer than my forearm, I grabbed it and gave it a few experimental swings before tucking it into my waistband to keep. At some point, my torch started to flicker, its battery close to dying, and I turned it off. If I just kept my hand on the wall, I figured I shouldn't get turned around. So I did just that and kept moving forward in the dark, trying to ignore the feeling that any second, I would drown in my own terror. 1 foot in front of the other, I muttered, over and over. Total darkness when I heard the whimpering grow suddenly louder, joined by a shuffling that bore down towards me like a motorbike I couldn't see. I resisted the urge to turn my light on and instead lowered myself into a ball, doing everything I could to be quiet and dark. I think at some point my heart started going on so quick I was worried it was going to give me away, beating a loud tattoo to alert this other of my presence. Whatever was coming sounded excited, maybe even a little frustrated, but I often think that I imagined that part of it. Whatever it was making its way right towards me. And just when I thought it would finally manifest as a clammy wet hand gripping my shoulder and dragging me off into its lair, it instead passed me by. And, just like a motorcycle, it disappeared into the space ahead as a fading drone. I wasn't quite ready to acknowledge the idea that it had really slipped me by, nor that I was safe. So I waited for what felt like an eternity until I finally stood up and carried on. When I saw the light a short while later, I could have cried out with relief, except my heart was still beating 1,000 miles an hour, and the way my legs and chest had felt, I couldn't possibly forget just how close I'd come to death a few minutes before. Whatever it was that had passed me by, it wasn't visible against the aperture of light, and I looked around desperately trying to figure it out. Instinctively, my hand made its way to the piece of metal in my waistband, and I found the weight of its heft reassuring. I felt ready, if that somehow makes sense. Alone, tired, and all too ready to finish it all, even if it meant dying. And yet I reached the exit without incident, and I stood there, panting, tears streaming down my cheeks, and stared at the rugged ocean as it dashed itself against the slate-gray rock. I could smell it, and it smelled so goddamn good I wanted to cry. And even better, I held up my phone and saw it coming to life with full signal and bars. I was already scrolling through my contacts when I saw tears strike the screen and immediately wiped my eyes, not wanting to lose sight of such a precious thing. Except my eyes were dry. I touched the fluid on my phone and rolled it between my fingers. It wasn't water. It was slick, and it smelled like rotting flesh. I looked up. I couldn't have said if it was ever even human, except I figured it must have been, and that thought makes me both scared and sad. But I don't know if it was male or female, or even old or young, only that it was where it shouldn't have been, clinging to the smooth arched ceiling above me, leering down with an evil grin and empty eyes. It had too many teeth to be a person. Maybe it collected them, maybe it grew them, I don't know. It was naked, except that it didn't mean much. Its genitals had withered or gone the way of its ears, nose, nipples, and lips. Remembering the rest of the infected I'd seen, it meant it had been torn off with jagged and nails and eaten whole. Maybe rot finished the rest of it off, because that thing was as smooth as a G.I. Joe down there, just skin, no wound or scars. Or maybe it had picked the remaining flesh so clean that it had healed as a single sheet. But not all of it could be explained with self-mutilation. Like I said, there must have been 30 teeth visible on the top row of its mouth, and they were all a mismatch of molars and canines of different colors, some growing out perpendicular to the rest. In its eyes, I've mentioned that the infected lost their eyes after a long, long time. I'm sure that's what happened to this thing, except that something else had grown into its place. It looked like a fleshy raspberry, and I figured that they didn't really work as eyes, because how could they? But they did swivel in their sockets, flickering side to side, almost as if they might be able to see. Maybe it was the way it held itself, but the way its arms came out of its back and the way its legs looked like a little double-jointed, it really did look like a spider with its gut dangling down. Its bones didn't look right, not even the ribs that I swear shifted around under while I stared right at them. That was the thing about it that made it so damn repulsive. It was never still, even though it didn't move. But all of it, bones, muscles, fingers, toes, they all moved about as if they had a mind of their own. Even its skull seemed to throb, looking more like a sack full of jelly than a bone-hard cranium. Thank God I had that pipe on me, and thank God I didn't think to turn and run towards the light, close as it may have been to me. Instead, I swung that pipe as hard as I could just as it dropped down in front of me. The timing was lucky, and I struck it hard across the head and sent it sprawling. I backed up suddenly and stood for the first time on the beach, desperately hoping that damn thing would stay the hell away. A very long arm with a hand that had too many fingers that branched at the knuckles slithered out towards me but retreated in desperation when the sun hit its skin. Perhaps I might have given it more thought, but I was already running towards the open sea and calling the number that old Mr. Rawson had handed out. "I'd trust this man," I remember him saying, "and no one else I'd trust with my life like this. Just tell him you know me and that you need picking up. He'll moan something awful, but he will come, and he'll come discreetly too." His words echoing in my mind now. Whoever was on the other side of that number, he thought the first call was a prank. I just couldn't get the words out. I wanted to. I really did. But I coughed and spluttered and whined, and nothing much of sense could be heard. I think it was because when I turned around, I saw that pallid hand furiously beating at the edges of the tunnel, doing everything it could to reach me despite the sun. I didn't even know the time, but didn't know how much longer the sun would be out. I calmed myself and tried again, and again, and eventually, I managed to say the words, "Mr. Rawson," without it being followed by a load of blubber and snot. I didn't have much to say, really, except I told him where I was, and that I needed to be picked up. He asked if I'd pay, and I told him I'd give him everything I had in the whole damn world just to see him soon. He didn't even make a remark, just muttered something about a favor, and I was left sitting on the sand hoping to hell I'd see a black spot on the horizon before the sun set. Whatever was in the tunnel, it was pissed. It never stopped fingering the brickwork at the edge, and it wasn't like I could make an easy escape on the coast. Sheer black walls of rock surrounded me on all sides, slick and without cover, and the tide was so high I had no hope of trying to follow it around to somewhere safer. All in all, there wasn't even 20 feet between the tunnel entrance and the sea. And as the clouds grew grayer and the wind colder, things started to feel increasingly claustrophobic. He arrived just as the sea was turning black and a few stars could be seen on the very edges of the sky. I acted quickly and threw some of my clothes into the tunnel, hoping that if anyone did go looking for me, they'd find them and assume I was eaten. That thing tore them out of sight so quickly I jumped, and the old man beside me turned pale. "What in God's name?" he asked. "Not him," I said. "Somebody else's work, more likely." A black helicopter flew overhead, and the old man, perceptible as he was, nodded as if it all made sense. They say things look clear from a distance. It's funny, but most of you won't bat an eyelid at the idea of government experiments or whole towns disappearing but to live it. In some ways, it was worse than the infection. At least they never had a choice. It hurts, like being betrayed by a friend hurts. Maybe I'd find it easier to swallow if deep down I didn't secretly think they were right to shut us off so harshly. An hour later, I crashed that dinghy on some beach a few miles east and hiked to safety. I found an old person's home of all things and stumbled in covered in blood and vomit. They took care of me as well as they could. It was only after I escaped on that boat that the idea of infection started to weigh on me, you see. Isn't that funny? I still wonder how it carried from person to person. Was I immune or just lucky? Or was it ever a disease, or just some mass exposure I somehow avoided? Some nights I think I must be the luckiest person in the world. Other nights I know better, and I know that my escape wasn't unnoticed. I think I'm still part of the experiment, or maybe it was a test, and what I did on that boat meant I passed with flying colors. It hadn't been 30 minutes before the old man asked me if I had any food. I like to think I did the right thing. I still had that metal bar. I knew I wasn't infected. I couldn't have eaten anything if you put a gun against my head. But that old man turned to me and said those words, and it was like the world changed colors in one swift motion. Like it was all a little redder somehow. He probably was just hungry, you know. I try not to think about it on the balance of probability that was the most likely reason he asked me. I mean, could the infection be all the way over here? I mean, that'd be pretty quick, but I'm not sure. I hope and pray that my exit from that town is final, and I can start anew here, a new life, and begin again.